This Fire Engineering Podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata Fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of your favorite show. I know it's one of mine. It's the Larry Conley Radio Show, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking maybe, just maybe this time, that's Larry Conley. But again, as you are so often during the intro to this show, you are incorrect. It's me, Dave Conley, winner of the Larry Conley Lookalike Contest at least 2 years running, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to win it again this year. Anyway, here to proudly announce tonight's show and to introduce our fearless leader. Ladies and gentlemen, you know him. You love him. Some of you have him up on child support. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Captain Larry Conley.
You did the best you could, yeah. Well, we're back. Thank you again, David, for that for the award-winning introduction. And
of course.
Yeah, right. And thanks for putting my business through about the child support. Even though I'm almost done with that. All the kids are grown and all that stuff. We're doing well.
It's public record.
Yeah, so child support works, you know. Those of you paying it, there's hope. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. Sometimes it's a train coming at you, but other than that, you know, it's all good. It's all good. So
my grandkids are worth it.
But anyway, say what?
My grandkids are worth it.
Yeah, your grandkids are worth it.
here we go.
I'll leave it there because, I mean, there's some choice words I could say about the whole subject, but I'll leave it there, you know, because this is a family show, and I don't want to break up the...
Praise God. Yeah. Thank you, Jesus.
Mm-hmm. But thank God they had a good civil service job to help, you know, take care of that obligation, but nonetheless, you know, so stay married, guys and gals, and you know, Stay together, make it work. So, you need some mutual victory, which is what we're going to be talking about tonight. So, you know, but
great segue.
Mutual victory. We had some mutual stuff going on while the kids were here in the first place. We did. The victory is the child support's over. But don't get me started. That's another show.
So we got.
I should have looked at my InVision, you know. So and then, you know. But and then we've been more proactive about, you know. And so anyway, I could run the table on this one, David. But I'm not going to do it.
I'm sure.
But
the show's only so long. Then, so.
Yeah. So anyway, the. The show was supposed to air, and we had a little. Tell you the truth, I'm not trying to capitalize on any grief or anything. But the last time the show was supposed to air, we were a little busy since we talked the last illustrious audience. We had some tragedy here in the St. Louis Fire Department, and. And you know, you read, you know, Billy Goldfield's close calls and talk about line of duty deaths and close calls, and you read about them, your heart goes out to everybody who loses a family member of their fire department, and you grieve. And if you don't know the person, there's even though you grieve because they're part of our whole universal fire family, there's still a bit of separation there. And so with that separation, you tend to send your condolences and maybe call the people you know in that department and send out your heartfelt condolences. And then, you keep it moving and keep them in your prayers. But when it happens close to home, and in my case, when it happens in your crew, it makes it real. You know, it's not just condolences real on social media or phone calls or, you know, maybe in striking distance or depending on you take a drive or a flight there or whatever. Even though you grieve with them, there's still a sense of separation. And you can't separate yourself when it's in your own backyard or in your own crew. So this didn't only happen to the St. Louis Fire Department. It happened on my crew. And one of my guys tragically lost his life fighting a house fire in our area. Firefighter Benjamin Polson and passed as we were. They were making a push to go in and check and see. We got a lot of vacant buildings in the city of St. Louis, especially in our district. And not only we got vacant buildings, but we also have the huge homeless population that occupy these buildings. And even though we try to secure them and board them up, as much as we do that, where there's a will, there's a way. And I can't tell you how many times we've gone in the buildings and, you know, retrieved homeless people just trying to keep warm, you know. And nobody knows. I always say, by the grace of God, when people want to be judgmental of why, I always say, by the grace of God, you live in a place that's heated and, you know, has all this facilities and all that kind of stuff. And over the course of my career, it'll be 30 years next month, I've seen some stuff, and I've seen some ingenuity and homelessness that I just never had to experience as a kid. Thank God to Mommy Lane on the phone, and we just never had to go through it. However, there are people who do, and anybody who calls the St. Louis Fire Department, whether it's a person who sees a fire or trapped in a fire or whatever, we come to get you. And we're going to put our life on the line to come get you. And I guess I speak for fire departments around the country when I say that. And we're an aggressive interior attack company, and we will go in and make that check, make the push. And if there's nobody in there, we need conditions change, and then we do what we have to do to make sure that we don't hurt anybody else in the process. But if not, then, you know, we got to do what we got to do. So they deserve to be saved just as much as the occupied homeowner or occupied person in the house deserves to be rescued as well. We don't have any respect of a person when it comes to that. And so I was out of town. I was in Florida for training, officer development course down there. When I got the word in the course, I couldn't get back to St. Louis fast enough. I left the conference early and got back here and went straight to the site where they were doing investigation. And it just became more real then when I got out here of what had happened. And it really humbles you. You know, we do what we do, and we just assume that when we go to work 24 hours later, we're going to come back home with just the same as we went to work. And so through all the training and through all the things that you try to do this job as safe as you can, unfortunately, one of the things that happens in this job is there may be life lost because it's a dangerous job. And we don't want it to happen, but it's part of what we do. Yeah, so we continue to answer your prayers for Truck 13C, and we're still healing. We're getting our counseling in. There's been a ton of support. We really appreciate that from around the country. I know a few people came to town. I know Bobby Halton drove to St. Louis for the funeral and support, and Forrest Reeder, a good friend, Forrest Reeder, and just a ton of other other people from surrounding states, and some people from, you know, far away also made their way to St. Louis. So we packed the church, the cathedral basilica, and sent Ben home with the heroes send off. So Ben's father was on the job. I knew his father. I knew his dad. Dad was a great firefighter, retired as a captain. And Ben didn't even have to do this job. Ben was like one of those brainiacs, and he was already had already graduated from law school and hadn't even taken the bar yet. So he chose to be a firefighter to, you know, for a lot of reasons, continue the legacy, and just felt like he was just calling to do. But he did it, and he would be forever be immortalized at Truck 13C in the St. Louis Fire Department. We're doing a lot of things around the engine house to kind of make sure that his legacy is not lost in the process. And so it was a rough time in a lot of ways. It's still a rough time, but the show must go on. There are other people still need to be rescued, saved, and taken care of. There's still cats that need to be getting off the trees. So, you know, we still got a job to do. And we just continue to learn from this tragedy and keep it moving, and to get used to our new normal, because it's definitely not normal when a member of your family is not there anymore. So, like I said, the show must go on. So, so anyway, if you missed us last time, we were going through a few things. You know, say what?
Keep his family. I was saying, keep his, you know, the Paulson family in your prayers.
Most definitely, the Paulson family. And the good thing about it is that we've been trying to make sure that the Paulson family is not forgotten. A lot of our firefighter families staying in touch with mom and dad, and making sure that, you know, because it's easy to, during the height of the tragedy, everybody is around you and wanting to help. But it's the moments after, you know, the months and the years afterwards. Are you still being in touch, and how genuine was your care? And so we're trying to make sure that they know that the family, our firefighter family, is still here. It never was lost anyway, since his dad was on the job. But we definitely want to make sure that Ben's legacy is not forgotten. So so anyway, we miss him, and he was quirky, he was funny. And he was in the process of just really learning this profession. And so anyway, I want to give a is just due, but I still wanted to make sure that I don't think you could say enough. I could do a whole show on it, but I don't think you could say enough about how much we miss our fallen brothers. So anyway, firefighter Ben Paulson. Benjamin Paulson, Truck 13C, and January 13 was the fateful day. So we'll continue to keep them in our prayers. But moving forward, tonight we are here, and we're live, right, Dave? We're live tonight. I mean, sometimes
we
record these things, but we're alive, so you can't X out.
Meaning we can have people call in.
If I say something goofy, yeah, maybe we can have them call in. This is
live.
And David, if they want to call in, what's that number if they want to call in there?
That number is 760-454-8852. My number again, 760-454-8852. Operators, as they say, are standing by.
Standing by, yeah.
Because,
you know what?
Because we don't have any chairs.
You know.
But.
Yeah, why do they have to stand? Wouldn't they be more comfortable just sitting by? But no, they make them stand up. So I would never want to be an operator, because my legs might get tired, you know. So it could be rough standing, you know. Especially, you know, you got the wrong shoes on. It could be a rough job, you know. So,
oh, my goodness.
I wouldn't stand for it.
No.
I can't hardly stand any of this.
Right. Yes, you can. Understand. Please understand that these jokes are free, ladies and gentlemen. You're not paying for this.
Thank you. And worth every penny. And worth every penny,
you know. But so tonight, But anyway, if you heard us talk in these last years we've been doing this show, and if you've seen us around the country teaching, and if you saw the keynote back in August, then what you know is one that we got seven areas that we cover when we talk about the Empower Model. And one of the things we talk about in the Empower Model is mutual victory. And when we talk about mutual victory, no, don't get it confused. We're not the advocates of everybody gets a trophy. Oh, no. I took my son to Little League basketball and other sport events, and they said anything like everybody gets a trophy or everybody, nobody, there are no losers here in the big scheme of the art of the winning and losing of the sport. I called Cortland and Joshua, my two sons, and I said, it's time to go because this is not life. Life is sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and that's just how it is. So, but that's that. But when you're talking about team building, relationship building, things of that sort, the mutual victory is important. Imagine, if you will, that, you know, if you're married to your spouse and your main goal was to always win and your spouse loses, and you had no DNA for mutual victory, how long would that relationship last? Probably not a long time. And all the quality of it would suck so much that you wouldn't want to be in it. So mutual victory is really important when you talk about relationships, whether you talk about your marriage or you're talking about working in teams. And in the fire service, it's critical that we learn how to work together at the firehouse. You depend on the team to make sure that the situation gets mitigated. And if you don't have a strong team or a team that understands the power of mutual victory, then that team is doomed, or it's going to be a long 24 or 48 hours or whatever you work. It's going to be long. And mutual victory, the reason we like to teach it, because it's ingrained in everything you do, from working together at the firehouse to negotiations if you're in a union to, it works its way through everything that we do when you work as a team, as an organization. And the teams and organizations that have mutual victory pretty much down pat are the ones who have the most success and more progressive. And when everybody wins in that arena, then it's better for the whole environment. And so anyway, if you want to get more details on some of the things we talked about with mutual victory, be sure to call us to your town, because we'll be coming to your town soon. We're going to be doing a lot of traveling, especially during the month of April, crisscrossing the country, discussing the Empower Model. But tonight, the reason we're focusing on it, because I got this special guest, and we were talking, I've met Frank before, and then when things happen to me like back-to-back-to-back, I always say, there must be a reason that I keep running into this. So I met Frank before, Frank Ritchie at FDIC, and then I, heard about Frank Ritchie before because of the Landmark case in New Haven, Connecticut. And then I talked to him at FDIC. I think even before I talked to him then, another thing that happened real quick, let me throw this in, a shameless plug. I finished school. You've been hearing me talk about school the last couple of years. Well, I finished all that, So I finished school, got a bachelor's degree from Columbia Southern University, and we'll be moving on to the master's. But at least I got the bachelor's down pat. So I got something that I envisioned. And got it going on, and so I was really happy about that. And thank you, appreciate it. And so I didn't want more people thinking, a degree means more child support. So I had to be careful. That's maybe on the low a little bit. But anyway, doing my one of my research papers was on Frank Ritchie. They're doing the case. So that was, so I said, man, and heard about him, talked to him, now I'm doing the case study. And then a random told me, FDI said, man, said, we need to talk about this because some of the outcomes, even though it was kind of the challenging going through it, some of the outcomes are the very essence of mutual victory. And I know sometimes we talk about it in a way that maybe is not as spectacular. Maybe you talk about it, you know, this is how I help my kids work something out, or we work something out at the firehouse. It may not seem to have the same impact. Can you have mutual victory on bigger and bigger and bigger scales? And I think today's climate, we need it more than ever because we are in such a cancel culture these days. I don't agree with you. You don't agree with me. Then, you know, you're an asshole. And then that's how that becomes. So that's the raw of it. And we can't have that working in these firehouses. We can't have that working as teams. We shouldn't have it as a nation. And we shouldn't have it with politicians. We shouldn't have it with, people that totally disagree with each other, because they're canceling each other out because you don't agree with me. In the long run, it hurts all of us. And so we have to understand that. It's not always easy to see when you're so passionate about my way or the highway kind of thinking. So anyway, after I talked to Frank at the FDIC this past year, we agreed that we need to get on the show and talk about this, how mutual victory works in the capacity of some of the things he's been through, some of the things he continues to do, and some of the people he's worked with that probably on the surface would look like, why is Frank working with this guy? You know, it seems like Frank has a grasp of the mutual victory. So tonight we're going to be talking to Frank Ritchie. He's a retired battalion chief, drill master, and union president for the New Haven Fire Department. And he also led the plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court case, Ritchie versus Stefano, and is an advisory board member for FDIC and Fire Engineering. He was a contributing author to the Firefighter's Handbook and the author of numerous fire engineering training DVDs. He has currently written a book called Command Presence and works for one of the nation's oldest think tanks. So I'll be interested to talk about that as well. So anyway, without further ado, let's talk to our friend, retired Battalion Chief Frank Ritchie. Frank, are we still on?
Larry, we're still on. Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. I don't know why you haven't changed the name to include your brother yet. So hopefully at the end of this week, we can negotiate that.
Thank you very much.
You're stirring stuff already, Frank. That's not mutual victory. No, go ahead.
We need a mutual victory for David. And
thank you. That's what I'm saying.
One of the things that I'd just like to say is, you know, my thoughts and prayers are out to Benjamin's family. And the one thing that we need to stop talking about is, you know, whether it's Benjamin or somebody else or another firefighter gets injured or hurt, firefighters don't get hurt in vacant buildings, because a building's not vacant until we search it. And the fact is,
right,
all human life has value, and
yeah,
he died a hero, and we need to remember him, but we also need to remember those who were with him that are still with us today, because they're dealing with some pretty unbelievable emotions, feelings, and things of that nature. But the fact is, no building is vacant until we say it is, because all life has value, and that's what firefighters do. We try to get you out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Very good. Very well put. Mm-hmm. So I know you and I have had a lot of off-air conversations regarding mutual victory and all. And so I wanted the case to be kind of a backdrop on, where you were at the time, your reasoning for the suit, and then from that, what kind of mutual victory relationships emerged from that based on what we talked about, because I think some very powerful relationships emerge from that may or may not have evolved to benefit, you know, the firefighters, the federal judge, fire chief, the New Haven Fire Department, things like that. May not have benefited the same way had it not been for the experience of the case, and not to mention your relationship with the mayor now today, even though you all had and still are kind of on opposite belief systems. So we really want to delve into that. So why don't you kind of walk it from there where you were to where we are now, and we'll go from there.
Well, the first thing, Larry, I, and David and your mom, and I really appreciate being on with the whole family, is that I think what you said is so important, that we need to continue to talk to each other. And when we stop talking to each other, that's where we fail as Americans. So we need to keep those lines of communications up. You gave an example earlier of a marriage. And what we often see with divorce is, what do? Somebody is the mother of our child, and we demonize them, and next thing you know, there's a divorce, and it's just bitter, and we just stop talking, and we stop communicating. So I always say, I've been married 27 years, I always say, you know, treat your wife like she's your second wife, because we got to care for each other. We got to move forward for our kids. And, you know, yeah, sometimes divorce happens, and it happens, but we can't demonize everybody we disagree with. And I really appreciate the show and the opportunity to come on. The Richie case that you asked about, and, you know, Southern University, Columbia University, they have people write a paper about it. But some of the reading that they require them to read, the individuals to read that are going through these programs, and congratulations on your bachelor's degree, some of the reading, I have sometimes students call me, and they, like, explain the case to me based off what they read. And I'm like, did we even win the case? It's not balanced. And I think that, you know, if we're going to have an honest conversation, we need to be honest. Eric Holder said that when it comes to race, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, when it comes to race, we're a nation of cowards. And a lot of times that is because if you have an honest conversation about race, and we need to, you're branded a racist without anybody even listening to what you have to say. So the Richie case comes out of, we took a test. And when we took a test with lieutenant and captain, the city provided a roadmap for success. They said, you know, you have to read and understand the policies and procedures. You have to read and understand the rule book. And the other books were fire engineering books, Francis Brannigan's building construction books, things of that nature. So everybody had an opportunity to purchase the books, study, and take an exam. The other thing that the city did that I think is very positive, and if departments aren't doing this, they should do this, is when you went, so you had a written test, and then you had an oral test. And when you had the assessment center for the oral test, they had minorities overrepresented on the panel. So there was one individual that happened to be black, one that happened to be Hispanic, and some panels had a female, a white female, or somebody who was white. And what they did was they only allowed consensus scoring. So they trained these assessors. So you would go in, you would sit, and then they would have to give you a consensus score. Now, it's been a long time, so I forget whether it was within a point or not, but the reason why that's important is when somebody was discriminated against, and whenever there's discrimination, we should root it out. What would happen is you'd go sit in front of a panel. Say, Larry, you sit in front of three people. Two people give you a 96, and one person gives you a 30 because of how you look. That tanks your score. And that leads to discrimination, and it leads to adverse impact. That wasn't the case on this test. There was no way for somebody to make a judgment and just tank your score because how you look, because when you left the room, they had to come up with a consensus score. So that means all three assessors, essentially within one point, I believe it was, had to agree on your score. And that is a good practice to prevent discrimination. So fast forward. We take the test. We do the written. We do the oral. And at the end of each test, there's a questionnaire from the test companies that say, was the test fair? Was it not fair? And overwhelmingly, everybody of all races said the test was fair. And then the results of the test came out. And the city, instead of having an honest conversation, what they did was they identified us by our Social Security numbers, and then they redacted them, and they only showed individuals' race. And they spread a lie that spread, and I want to say this lie went on for probably 6 or 7 months because, unfortunately, in America, the press has always been one of the pillars of our democracy. But instead of doing the research, and how often do you hear today where, according to the New York Times or according to the Washington Post, is that once the lie got out that no minorities passed the test, that was the equivalent of pouring gasoline in the room, lighting a match, and walking away. The city's goal was to not tell anybody where they were on the list, and their goal was to get people of different races fighting against each other. That was the intention of the city to scuttle the exams. So once they put out the, and I'll try to move this along real quickly. As soon as they announced that, then they brought in a couple experts to review the test. And one individual who happened to be black, I think he was a captain or don't quote me on that. I think he was a past captain in Chicago, and he worked for Homeland Security now in his retirement job. He said, given the reading list, given the time of study, he could have done well on both exams. And then the other two individuals never saw the test. But one individual from Boston University testified at the civil service hearing that black firefighters and white firefighters do the job differently. I still can't reconcile that to this day. I train firefighters, and firefighters are firefighters. We all do the job the same way. I don't see that distinction. I can't reconcile that. And while I can see bias on a entry-level exam where you could have bias, this was a promotional exam. So everybody's in the same socioeconomic bracket. Everybody makes the same money. Everybody knew what the books were. And we actually got penalized for mentoring firefighters who happen to be on minorities. So, for example, I had an individual on my shift, smart guy. And I said, hey, Mike, are you going to take the test? And he said, no, I got kids at home. I'm starting a mortgage company selling mortgages. I got a lot going on. And we, a whole bunch of us on the shift were like, no, Mike, even if you don't want to be promoted, take the test so you get the experience. You should never, anybody listening, if a promotional test comes up, you should take it, even if you don't want to get promoted, just so that you understand the process. So here is Mike. He had no intention of being promoted. He didn't study. He didn't purchase the books, but he took our recommendation to take the test for the experience of taking the test. And yet they took Mike not as an individual. They took Mike as a statistic and used that against everybody else. And the other thing is, plenty of minorities passed. And not only did plenty of minorities pass, we all knew that lists last for 1 to 2 years in New Haven. So we knew that right off the bat that they were going to get to qualified minorities. And the ironic thing is the qualified minorities that they got to right now as we stand here today, one is the chief of operations for the New Haven Fire Department, who happens to be black. Another individual is a deputy chief. Two more individuals retired as deputy chiefs. One retired as a battalion chief. So all races, white, black, and Hispanic, has succeeded through other tests. And in the testing world, and I don't pretend I'm smarter than I am, but industrial psychologists who kind of maneuver around tests, they say that the mark of a good test is if you take another test, if you score, if you place kind of, one or two spots from the other test, because most people are consistent. You'll always have an anomaly of somebody who works that extra hard and, excels. And you can see that the testing going through the careers is that the individuals that scored well on that initial test that they threw out scored well on the other tests going up, and now we're all promoted. So it was really the city trying to divide us against each other. Is that a good overview? I don't want to get too in-depth.
Yeah, sure. Now, when you say that, because and thanks for so far, because you've been really, you know, you filled in a lot of blanks. What was the motivation you feel when you say the city was trying to divide against each other? What do you think the motivation is? Why would the city do that, in your opinion?
New Haven is an extremely progressive city. And, you know, some progressive policies are great, but, I mean, there's no such thing. It's one-party rule. There's no such – you'd have a better chance of seeing a Tyrannosaurus Rex in the city than a Republican. So it's a one-party rule, and what they wanted was they wanted to engineer an outcome. They wanted to engineer a result and not based off of merit and the test. I would have felt so much better if at that first – civil service hearing, if they just asked everybody, you know, did you purchase the books? Did you apply yourself? You know, merit knows no race. It just doesn't. Anybody can succeed if they work hard, and I am a firm believer in equal opportunity. And if there's not equal opportunity, then we need to stand together, stomp it out, and speak up together. But they weren't interested in the process. They were only interested in a result, and they thought that, hey, if we don't give anybody their scores, nobody's going to be crazy enough to fight this. And one of the things that the public is kind of lost on the public is the New Haven 20, the 20 individuals who challenged this, 19 white, one individual happened to be Hispanic. Out of the 20, only 14 of us got promoted. So it wasn't everybody that fought. We fought for the process, to be fair, because it took us over a year to find out where we were on the list.
Let me ask you another question, too, because and this has been something that's been historic in a lot of cities and around the country, because they've had to make changes, you know, to make sure that everybody had the chance. And I can't speak on this test because you took this test and you know it better than I do. However, historically, there have been, you know, tests in the past that have been proven that wasn't fair to minorities and fair, you know, or certain people got denied, other people who didn't have the advantage did and stuff like that. With that being the case, and like you said, based on, you know, how you just described this, you don't feel like this is one of those tests. But with that type of history, do you think they were trying to use this to say that type of history was part of this test? Or do you believe that type of history actually have existed in these civil service tests before?
Well, I think it's a known fact, Larry, that what you're describing has occurred in American history to keep minorities down. And there's actually a Supreme Court case. Duke Power Plant is the case. And in the Duke Power Plant case, instead of giving a merit-based test of what were the skills, knowledge, and abilities to work in a power plant, they gave an IQ test. So they were trying to, and I'm not, you know, I think intelligence is across the board. You're probably a lot smarter than I could ever even pretend to be. The fact of the matter is, though, if at the time when the Duke Power Plant case came out, a lot of minorities weren't going to college at that time, statistically speaking. So they engineered that test to actually be discriminatory, to hold people back that were minorities, and that was 100% wrong. And that's where you got the EOC guidelines from today, which I agree with. I have no issue with that. That test should not have been allowed because it had nothing to do with operating a power plant. So the EOC guidelines as it stands today is if you have a test that has adverse impact on it, you have a test where something just looks off, it raises the red flag. I'm okay with that red flag. Then what you have to do is you go back and you look at the test, and you have to see if the test was job-related. If the test wasn't job-related, it should be thrown out, and I agree with that 100%. If the test is job-related, then the legal term is it meets business necessity, and it should be certified. So we actually won our case on Title VII, the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So I am, you know, I've always thought that, you know, and this goes to that mutual victory of what Chief Austin, myself, and the union was able to accomplish is a test shouldn't be, you shouldn't give a test and not want people to know the answers. This is the fire service. You know, we talked about Benjamin early. I mean, our firefighters would make their wife or husband a widow and their kids parentless for the community we serve. We want people to have a roadmap for success, and we want people to know the answers. That's why you're teaching all around the country, is you want people to have the answer. So, yes, I agree with you. There was vast discrimination, especially leading up in the 60s and 50s, where they were trying to engineer tests to hold back minorities, and that's just blatantly wrong.
Okay. Well, good, because I want to make sure that you people understood that, how you felt about it. Second thing is you brought it up. You mentioned it before, and I just want to make sure that that's understood on that's your position as well, is that if you're talking about an entry-level exam, entry-level exams can be biased because, you know, depend on where you grow up or what you know how to do or what side of the tracks you're from. They can actually guide a test to say, we know that this test will be more favorable to a certain party just because of, you know, we understand the demographic. And then the other demographic wouldn't have the same knowledge base based on what side of the tracks they are. And you can very well discriminate coming into the service. But after you get in the service, and everybody should have, like you were talking about with you and Chief Austin, were able to put together, should have the same information, no secrets, no secret list, no secret reading list, nothing like that, where everything's on the table. Then it's your belief that at that point, if everybody has the access to the same information, then you have a fair testing process, then now we have a better gauge of who's going to get promoted based on it being a lot more even than the entry exam. And so there probably also needs to be just as much work done on the entry exam too, on the front end, just to make sure that, you know, we have the correct ratio to probably match how the city looks that you work for. So that's something that, you know, that's, I'm trying to kind of clarify that as we move on, that that's part of what you understand and believe and working toward as well.
Well, I think a lot of, just to phrase it, we need to make sure the entry-level exams don't have discrimination on it. I don't think you could have a quota number. I think it's got to be based off merit, but I think we need to do a better job of recruiting in minority communities, 100% for that. I think one of the keys is explorer programs, and I think, you know, I was an explorer, so I think being an explorer and having, you know, giving members of the community those tools and those opportunities, for example, to take an EMT class, get the individual an actual certification. So if they don't get on the fire department right away, they can work for an ambulance company or vice versa. But we need to give skills, and I'm 100% for community outreach, and explorer programs, I think, are really kind of, exploring junior programs are really the way to open the door. I think the key to diversity is education, not quotas. And one of the things that I have a problem with recruiting that I think needs to change is when we recruit somebody, and I hate to break things down to race, but we're having a conversation about race, so we pretty much got it. When we're advocating and we go into a community and we're trying to get somebody to join an explorer program in the suburbs, nobody mentions what a firefighter makes. They talk about what a firefighter does for the community, how, you know, you'll come home from work, you'll be happy every day, and they focus on the job. One of the mistakes I see is in the minority communities, we tend to lead with, this is your key to the middle class. This is about the paycheck and the benefits. And I think that's a mistake, and I think we do a disservice to the minority community. I think we need to sell it the same way we sell it to the suburbs. Does that make sense?
That makes sense in a perfect world, but where I might slightly disagree with you is this. When you have a disparity in wealth, I'm just going to use the word wealth, and none of us are wealthy. You're trying to be a firefighter, you're trying to be wealthy, so you and I understand that. But what I'm saying is wealth as far as maybe resources and money and things like that, because when you're talking about a lot of minority communities, and I know this, being a minority growing up on the north side of St. Louis, you know, you may not always have everything that your white counterparts have. And I'm not trying to get too much in the weeds, because every time I say that, somebody, well, no, I ate beanie weenies every day too. That's okay. I'm not trying to debate, you know, have a who ate the worst meals or whatever like that. But what I'm trying to say is that in the county or the suburbs, so to speak, that's a different experience. So maybe finances don't really appeal to them, because they kind of got some automatic things that are financially, you know, just automatic. Where in the urban setting, it may not be as automatic. So it's kind of like one of those things where you know your audience. You know, you talk to your audience a certain way in certain places. David and I travel all the time. Depending on what the audience is, not that our subject matter changes, but maybe how we deliver it so we can keep everybody engaged. So if I come to, you know, some parts of North St. Louis, and I get to talking about service and pride and all that, it may awaken some people, but maybe what's going to appeal to them more is let them know that, hey, you don't have to repeat this cycle of poverty. Here's a way to kind of get out of that cycle of poverty, where there might not be the same conversation in the suburbs. You can get out of the cycle of poverty. Out of the cycle of poverty, I got a car when I was 16, or I got this, or I don't have to worry about that, or, you know, that kind of deal. So the only – I understand what you're saying in the perfect system, and maybe you could still say the same thing. You just have to balance it a little more. But I don't think it's as cut and dry as the same message needs to be in both audiences, if that makes sense.
I think that makes perfect sense, and I just want to make sure that I'm perfectly clear. I'm not saying that you don't go ahead and say that this is a way to break the cycle of poverty. The fact is, mm-hmm. our wages, benefits, and you're not going to get rich being a firefighter. You're going to end up getting hurt by the end of your career. That's just the reality. So I'm not saying that, and I'm not saying that you don't say that. I'm just saying you don't lead with that, because and this is my scope of experience. The first day of the academy, when you say, you know, one of the questions we like is how did you feel when you got your letter that you got hired by the fire department? And you go around the room and you want them to lead with, I want to give back to the community that gave me so much. I want to make a difference. I want my mom to be proud of me. You don't want that person, and I've seen it, say, I'm here for the pay and the benefits. That's a 20-year problem. And that's what I'm saying. So you have a lot of different people that I normally wouldn't talk about. So I'm not saying don't talk about breaking the cycle of poverty and your health benefits and your pay. I'm just saying don't lead with it. Don't make that the number one thing. Make this about the job and then explain that, and I think that would be helpful. So I don't think we're as far off as you think.
No, and I'm not saying that we are. I'm just saying that sometimes – language has to be different. Now, and like you said, I've taught more recruit class than I can remember in the fire service, so I don't have a attitude in the recruit class, come on, y'all, let's get this money, you know, whatever like that, because to me, you done lost it at that point, because if we all talk about getting that money, then you're going to start counting the dollars on how much that adds up to me running in this burning building when everybody's running out. Or you gonna count the cost of me laying my life on the line for people I don't know? So no, I'm not saying that that's definitely what you lead by, but it definitely has to be part of the conversation in certain communities because, and like I said, not the conversation, but part of it. But we, like you said, we definitely are not, on opposite ends of the spectrum with this. I just didn't want to leave one out and place the other because in some communities, in some demographics, that's just as important to me falling in love because when I first became a firefighter, I was one of those kind of people that just chased the fire truck when I was a kid and, had my dad's helmet fall out the, and I was on the cover of Life magazine. That wasn't me. It seemed like a good civil service job. And then I ended up falling in love with it the more I got involved with it. And then the money became secondary in the sense that it was adequate enough for me to feed my family. But the love of the job and the love of service and all that kind of stuff became more prevalent, from that standpoint. Because you and I both know that there are more volunteer firefighters in America than they are, firefighters who make money, So what are they doing it for? So we definitely can't say that being a firefighter is all about the money or you, because you'll never get rich just being a firefighter. And so that's fine. Moving ahead, so you and the mayor, this thing went to the Supreme Court. You and the mayor were the opposite ends of the spectrum with this. The mayor now teaches at Yale. Tell us about the mutual victory in that relationship that you guys have now. Maybe kind of start with where you were when you kind of start dealing with each other and then walk it up to the relationship you have today.
Well, as you can imagine, it took over 7 years as this worked its way through the court system. The city had no promotions at all. And, before I get there, one thing I want to mention that I think is relevant is, listen, it doesn't have to be this kind of issue, but any issue. In your career, at some point in time, if you're a firefighter, you're going to get disappointed. And don't let anybody ever take away your passion. So right after the case happened, I got asked to go teach the next recruit class. And my phone was like ringing crazy saying, why would you go teach a recruit class for the city after what they did to you? And I'm like, do you think the mayor would care if a firefighter doesn't know their job? It's an honor to teach the recruit class. This has nothing to do with that. So don't ever get to the point where you're get so bitter that you're like, I'm not doing anything for this department. So even though we were going through this, we always kept our head up high, and we always knew that it was always still about the community. It was always still about firefighters, and the New Haven 20 conducted themselves with that in mind. So after the case was over, of course we were attacking each other on CNN, on Fox News, on MSNBC. It was going back and forth. This was a very contentious thing. One day I get a call from a student from Yale who's asking me about the case. And I'm like, hey, fill me in. Why don't we meet for coffee? And it turns out they were writing maybe their thesis or they were doing a report on it. And John DeStefano was the teacher. And I said, well, how'd you find my number? And he goes, oh, John DeStefano, the mayor of New Haven, past mayor, gave me the number. And I think what's important is that even though we completely 100% disagree, and sometimes we, attacked in the press here and there, the fact is we always respected each other and understood that we were just advocating strongly for our positions, and we always respected each other. Now, I disagreed with his position, but I always had mutual respect, and I understood what he was trying to do, even though I disagreed with how he was going about doing it. So from the case on, every year he sends me one or two students to kind of write the pros and the cons about the case. And to his credit, he's a lifelong Democrat, very progressive. I'm a conservative. And here he's willing to say, look, it's okay to disagree in America, but it's okay also to listen to both sides without demonizing your opponent to the point where you don't even hear what they're saying anymore, even if at the end you decide to disagree with them. And, I think in over the years, more people sided with John than me, but he's the one grading the papers. So I think that's fair.
That's pretty good. And I like what you said about that because, like I said, in today's culture, we just don't do that enough. If you disagree with somebody, the next thing on the checklist is demonize them, destroy them any way you can, and that becomes, you know, another one kind of bites the dust in that regard.
Larry, now, I want to just add something. Larry, if I can add something on about that, that has nothing to do with the topic. So when I got hired in New Haven, I already worked in Montgomery County, Maryland, and then I worked in a small town, and then I got hired in New Haven. And one of the first things I did was I had a party at my house. And, you know, this was long before the case. And I invited everybody that I respected, you know, and I noticed in my backyard, it was like I lived on like a postage stamp thing. My wife was a stay-at-home mom, you know, the hardest job in the world. But, you know, I didn't have a lot of money, so we lived on this little postage stamp. And even in this small yard, we had a little bonfire going. And I noticed, like, all these, like, little groups. And I'm like, what is going on here? All these people I hold in such high esteem. And I forget who it was, came up to me and said, oh, it's mutual jealousy. I go, what's that? And they go, well, everybody here is jealous. They can't all believe they're at the same party. I go, listen, I judge people off one very simple premise. If I do something stupid at a fire, then try to save me. If they complain about each other when they're the ones that would help them out when everything went wrong in a fire. So we need to kind of look at people as individuals and say, hey, you know, just because we disagree with you on one issue, when we're at work, can we work together? And is that person going to do everything possible to make this operation a success?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true, because I say it, and Dave and I talk about it all the time when we teach our classes, is that, you know, we have to have that trust. And that's why, because I know when politics really started hitting, you know, just, you know, hitting these heights in the last seemingly 10 years or whatever, you know, the subject has come up in sometimes my classes or other classes I've been in where they'll talk about, you know, this comes on TV and it becomes a discussion. What do you do? And some people say, hey, we don't talk about it. We turn the TV off. We say we just here to fight fires and we don't get into it. I don't care what your politics is. You shouldn't care about mine. I never agree with that. I think that we should lean into it. What do you think about this? What do I think about this? Respectfully listen to each other. Respectfully understand that you have a different point of view. But at the end of the day, I hope I have some idea how you feel about stuff if my life got to be in your hands, because I don't want too much stuff to be so much of a mystery that it makes me stutter step with you as my partner in the, you know, highly risky situation. So we need to have some understanding, and we need to develop skills to help us respect each other, even though we may disagree. You know, so I never did agree that we just don't talk about it, because I just think that, you know, that's, you got to have that courageous conversation sometimes, but have the rules be, let's do it respectfully. And at the end of the day, if we don't agree, we're going to agree that we have objectives here that need to be done to serve our community. And we need to do this as a team, no matter what our politics, because we don't knock on the door and when somebody's house is burning, ask them what their politics. What was you watching when we came in? Sean Hannity? Okay, we out. Or what was you watching when we came in? Don Lemon? Okay, we out. You can't do that. You go in to save people no matter what without asking, you know, how they lean one way or the other. So we should, if we treat the public like that and say we'll die for the public, for the people we don't know, I got to kind of trust that when we working together at the firehouse with those that we do know, and if we crapping on each other at the firehouse, it kind of makes me not believe the T-shirt you're wearing talking about I'm doing it for the public, because you really don't know them, but you know the person you're working with on your team. So the mutual victory needs to be really strong at the firehouse before we even hit the street, you know.
We got a caller. Let me just bring him in real quick. Okay, caller, you live. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know what I'm really tired of is hearing a greasy old Italian tell me about the world there and they live up in New Jersey, and they take cabs everywhere. They're driving through tunnels and things, and everything's wonderful, and their grandma makes homemade pasta every goddamn Sunday. Fuck them. That's what I say.
All right, okay. So we're done with that.
Wrong show. Right. If it was one district, if it was one digit off from your of the other,
yeah.
I'm not going to talk about
from
that.
The problem.
But so, you know. I don't know, but anyway, moving right along. But now that they're talking about the leaders gone, tell our little brother stop taking his medicine, stop calling in, you know. So tell us about Victor Bolden, Frank.
So Victor Bolden, federal judge Victor Bolden, was brought in by the city when we got to the United States Supreme Court. He was, I believe, chairman of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, Harvard graduate, consummate professional. And he came on to kind of maneuver the case through. And, you know, he was the face of the city. He was on CNN opposite of us, on Fox News opposite of us. And when the decision came down, you know, this went through so long and so many meetings and so many court proceedings that I really got to know Victor Bolden. I mean, as somebody that I hold in high esteem. And as the case winded down and the Supreme Court ruled, instead of doing legal maneuvering and trying to hold up everybody's life, Victor realized that the fire department needed to move forward after all these years of no promotions. So instead of playing games, he ended up kind of working with the New Haven 20. And in something that's very interesting about this case that a lot of people don't realize is, Larry, if you and I walk out of a restaurant together and we fall on the ice and we both break our legs, I don't sue and you sue. You may get money, I get nothing. That's the way the legal system works, even though we had the same injury. However, we worked with Victor, and the city was ordered to certify the list. So instead of just promoting the 14 out of the 20, we were okay with them certifying the list like the list was actually certified. So the individuals that, whether they were white, black, or Hispanic, that would have got promoted within that original 2 years received their promotions right alongside with the New Haven 20. So we had, when the list got certified after the Supreme Court case, 3 individuals that happened to identify as black, 2 individuals that happened to identify as Hispanic, and I forget the number of whites. So the list went forward. Fast forward, Victor and I had to deal with each other on a regular basis, you know, my role in the union. He was the city corporation counsel. We've got to know each other. And we got to respect each other. And so he was appointed by President Obama to sit on the federal court. And as you know, at the time, especially with the Ritchie case, the Republicans were loaded for bear for him. So I actually provided testimony for Victor Bolden before the Judiciary Committee to stop the Republicans from filibustering his appointment. Victor then was appointed to the federal bench. Ironically, I think I was the only Republican at his invocation, which is another fancy word for a ceremony. And 2 United States senators actually quoted my testimony in the importance of what I had to say to get him to the federal bench. Something I didn't tell you, Larry, that was kind of interesting. Years later, after he got on the federal bench, I saw him maybe once or twice since then. Didn't talk to him for years. The day that I retired, I got a phone call from Federal Judge Victor Bolden congratulating me on my retirement. So, like I said, you can be on opposite sides of things, but we all have to respect each other. And, you know, he was 100% against me, you know, and I was 100% against him. But yet, we didn't let that issue define our relationship as individuals, and we were able to work through it. And I think that's a valuable lesson to your listeners.
It is. It is, for especially supporting mutual victory, like we talked about. David, give that phone number again, and then you said we got, I think we got a caller, so go get a phone number.
Yeah, the first of all, the number to call in is 760-454-8852. That number again, 760-454-8852. And on the phone, Dave is ready to talk. Dave, how you doing?
I'm good, Dave, and Uncle Larry and Frank, who I was just talking to a few hours ago. I had to listen in because I saw Uncle Larry, Dave, and Frank are all on the same show. So I'm like, all right, let me listen in. And then I heard that buffoon call in talking trash like an imbecile. So I apologize that you guys had to deal with that. And I wanted to say congratulations to Uncle Larry on becoming a grandfather. That's huge.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
It goes all around.
Chris, who is this?
Dave. Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. So my name is Dave McGlynn, and I have the fortune of being able to teach with these fine gentlemen for the past few years.
I just didn't want you not acknowledging me, their mother, you know.
I'm so sorry. I did not know. So you're the champion of all of them, ma'am, so thank you. You did a great job. Look at her calling me right out. Now I feel like I got yelled at by my own mother.
Right, exactly.
See how we grew up then.
Yeah, I see. Got a lot of practice with that.
Right. Welcome to our world.
Just teasing.
No, that's fine, ma'am. Thank you. I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Okay.
Well, we're glad you called in. Did you have any more to add or any questions?
Yeah, listening to the topic. So, Uncle Larry, you and I, we just recently graduated from Columbia Southern, so we had to do a paper actually on Frank's case. So I had reached out to Frank when that assignment came out. And Frank schooled me when I wrote my first submission and I sent it to him in proofreading. He says, maybe you should re-review the case. but it is. It's an interesting thing that had happened in our history. I think it's a good thing that it's happened in our history because we can talk about it. We're blessed that we have a brother and friend and cadre and Frank that he's able to share that story with us. But it reminded me and never – ever in anything that I talk about, teach, whatever, do I reference any of the fire shows, right? But if you remember Rescue Me when they had the sensitivity training show and it just, well, because Uncle Larry, because what you were talking about before about, you know, going into a house and you don't care if somebody's watching Hannity or Don Lemon, you know, and it made me think like, you know, I'm of Irish descent, you know, my heritage or whatever. And it made me think of that episode when Dennis Leary's character says, when the day that I go and judge somebody by the color of their skin or their religion or anything like that, you know, is when you can come and take, you know, my pink Irish ass out of the fire service. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact because we don't do it for that, you know, like you, Uncle Larry, like we all know you as Uncle Larry, you know, like you're, that's our business.
And
we're
now
family.
Gampy Larry.
Yeah, that's right.
That is right.
Right.
My wife is Puerto Rican, so he would be known as he's viejo, but he's also a abuelo now, you know.
Right.
He's an old man and a grandpa now.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I just I always enjoy your guys' material. But just on that, it just for your audience, for the people listening, and obviously what you know what you guys have gone through in your struggles, Dave, with what you do with film and all, and then Uncle Larry with what you do with down there in St. Louis, and then Frank, you know, with your situation, you know, all of us, the thing about all of us is that we can all kind of empathize with each other, because the fire service, now there really are some ill-willed, nasty people out there, but for the most part, we're a big family, and nobody cares about what your political view is, or what your background is, because at the end of the day, we're all eating dinner at the kitchen table together. We're all family.
You know, like my own personal life, I don't get along with my brothers or my sister about one or two things, but they're still my brothers and my sister. I love them, you know?
Yes, definitely. Most definitely. Most definitely.
That's good.
Good point. Good point. But, yeah, that just goes to show that, and that's why I like having these conversations, because we sometimes the consensus tends to be that we definitely, as long as we agree with each other, then it's harmonious, and don't realize that we don't have to agree with each other and can still be harmonious. And to me, that's a true test of your character, because it's easy to be cool with people you get along with. It's the people you don't get along with and have to. It's the true test. And then when you talk about promoting and one day leading a battalion or leading a shift or leading a department, if you kind of sucked at the beginning in the firehouse from getting along with people, how are you going to lead a department or a battalion or whatever, you know? So you need to get that practice in now and just don't think that, well, one day if I get promoted, automatically some pixie dust is going to flow down and I'll learn how to help people get along. You got to lead that by example, you know. So I think that's what makes great leaders in the fire service or anywhere for that matter.
Let me ask Frank.
Amen, I agree.
I'm hearing, you know, like about how you guys had a sort of, or at least after the case, have a sort of, you know, mutual victory atmosphere to your relationship, whatever state it's in. And this is you and the civil rights attorney gentleman or the former mayor, all of you. But during the case, when these opposing viewpoints would have been at its hottest, were you always like that, or was there a turning point where you realized, you know, hey, we have these differing opinions, but we don't necessarily have to be disagreeable human beings? Was there an incident or episode that happened that created that, or was it something that was just kind of like that from the beginning?
I'd say that it was tough from the beginning, that on the New Haven 20 side, we always continued to treat everybody with respect, and we knew that we still had to go to fires. And New Haven's a busy city. We still had to perform for the community. So we talked to everybody. Ironically, a New York Times reporter came to my shift. And she came to my shift in the middle, and she was, of all that's going on, when everything was really hot. And what she was hoping to find was everybody, like, on opposite sides of the firehouse. And what she found is a table of firefighters eating together. And that happened. I worked on a very diverse shift, and I drove the front of a tiller truck, and my tillerman, Lou Bosley, was black. So we don't leave anybody on the turntable in New Haven. So even if it's a 12 pitch, we're chopping or we're cutting on it. So we'll put the ladder up or grab somebody from a window and then get to the roof. But the two of us were counting on each other every day, more than anybody else. No officer goes to the roof in the city of New Haven. So she was, like, amazed that we were all eating together. Here's a diverse group of individuals sitting at this big table eating dinner. And she said something that was really, like, funny. She goes, I know that some of you may feel uncomfortable talking to me right now with everybody here. So here's my card. And a firefighter grabbed the card, and I won't say his name, but he goes, listen, I'm not going to call you about that, but I might call you for a date. And it was just some individuals, though, who were on the opposite side, thought that the best way was to not talk to each other. So I had Gary Tinney, who was on the polar opposite side. We responded to a fire on El Grasso Boulevard together. I'm driving the truck. I'm trying to talk to him, and he wouldn't talk to me. Here's a lieutenant. He was, I think, president of the Firebirds at the time, and he wouldn't talk to me. And I'm like, Gary, this has nothing to do with the case. We're going on fire. And he wouldn't talk to me, and I just thought that was wrong. But besides that, like, isolated case of having an individual that was working overtime not talk to me as a driver, pretty much the job went on like it wasn't even happening. We're a very diverse job. I mean, at the time, We had a white fire chief, but our assistant chief, who thought the list should be certified, was Ron Dumas. And his wife, I think, was the treasurer of the NAACP, but the mayor ordered Ron Dumas and Mike Grant, they put a gag order on them, and they weren't allowed to talk about the test. So the job itself was stayed pretty together. It was just some individuals. But I think the mutual victory in it is when John Alston came to New Haven. So John Alston comes to New Haven, and a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with John. FDIC teaches anybody from fire engineering familiar with John. Great guy.
We had him on the show before.
Oh, you have? Okay, so he's getting confirmed, hopefully, as fire chief of New Haven tonight. He's getting reappointed. So John and I got together, and I was the union president at the time when he came. And we talked, and we're like, listen, why is it a surprise every time there's a lieutenant, captain, or battalion chief's test on, okay, now here's the books you have to study? I said, basically, we're setting people up based off if they just had a kid or they got some job thing. So me and John worked together and said, why don't we develop a promotional reading list that goes from lieutenant, captain, battalion chief, deputy chief, all the way up the ranks. And we'll agree that these are the books we're going to use. And if the addition changes within 6 months of the test, you'll use the previous addition. So if it's 5 months before the test, John Norman's fire officer tactics book, he gets like the seventh edition, God bless Sean, whatever edition he's in, well, then you're using the old edition. If it changes before that six-month mark, then you use the new edition of John Norman's book. And you're still having the rules and regulations. You're still having the department's SOPs. And then you're having agreed upon books. So John and I were able to do that. And I think that I don't understand why every department in the country isn't like that. We want people to know the answer. So this allows people to be studying all the time. The other thing that we agreed on, John and I, we signed as an MOU, is we also set for the city a promotional testing schedule based off vacancies. So it wasn't a, you know, the city can test anytime they want. However, if they hit a mark of one deputy chief being vacant, I'm giving you arbitrary numbers here, three battalion chiefs, 10 lieutenants, five captains, the city would have to test. So it's kind of like your refrigerator. If you open up your refrigerator, you can go to the grocery store at any time. Okay, so the city can test at any time they want. However, if there's no food in your refrigerator, if you hit the benchmark, then the city has to test. And what that did for management was it allows human resources to plan for fire department promotional tests, where normally you're competing with the police department, public works, and who is the favorite son in the city at that time. So there's a limited resources. But now with the union coming together, now we took precedence over parks, police, and everybody else that they had a legal agreement that they had a test. So not only did we get the reading list thing done, we got the promotional test done, so we'll keep our ranks filled. And I think that that's something that Chief Alston and I can look back on and that we're proud of. And I think that other departments would really benefit by giving members that kind of roadmap for success. And the agreement says, you know, management and labor can come together, say if Dobson doesn't ever redo his book again. Well, then they could take that book out and mutually agree on a new book. But I think that's so important. We want people to succeed, all people.
Right.
So right. I'm really proud of that, Larry, and I wish that other departments would learn about it.
I do, too. I do, too, Chief. That would be nice. But like I said, that's a very progressive thought, a very good example of mutual victory, and a very good example of the fire chief and the labor boss working together. Because, like you said, you got that. Because here's the deal. If everybody does, quote, unquote, know the answers, it's still going to shake out as about as fair as it can, because there are some people very good at the oral presentation part of stuff, and there are people who need a lot of work but not as good. There are people who are very good at the written part of it, and there are people who are not, and they have, everybody has to practice accordingly. But at least if you got a bank of all the correct information at your base, it's up to you to decide how much you want to excel or not excel at the given resources. But if the resources are kind of, you know, one group of people have the resources, the other people don't, and just different variations of that, it throws a lot of monkey wrenches and things, and it's a wonder that, you know, anybody wins, or I wonder why there's such a, you know, a problem with the test-giving, test-taking process. Let me ask you another question based on that. I just thought of this. So since you all have done the testing in that sense, have the numbers or has the diversity looked better as far as those outcomes based on it? Do you have any data that shows that it's beneficial? Because I know in theory it sounds really good that everybody understands and knows it, but has there been, have you seen improvement in the diversity on the outcomes?
I would have to defer to John to do like an analysis to actually come up with it, but anecdotally, I think that there is. I just don't know how it shakes out because we now have more diverse classes coming in. So, of course, that's naturally going to increase diversity as more individuals come on to the department. So I'd ask John to kind of do an analysis. But anecdotally, I think, yes, we have more diversity. And New Haven's always been a diverse department, whether it's been chief of, you know, this isn't our first chief of operations that happened to be black. His last name was Black, was the chief of operations before Mark Vendetta. So, and we had an assistant chief. So the fact is New Haven's always been a diverse department. But, yes, I think anecdotally we've seen better results now that people can understand and study the books. You know, like I said, the key to diversity is education. And I truly believe that.
Yeah, I think it is something to be said that if you know from the beginning the resources you need and then you invest in those resources from the beginning all the way till it's time to take the test, you increase your chances of success on the test opposed to
Larry, and one other thing that I want to say, Larry, one of the things that I think we need to point out too is that, okay, you got the reading list now, you're all set. Now say you're a lieutenant. You're going for your captain's test. You still need to prep for that assessment center or oral exam.
Right.
And there's so many individuals out there that do test prep, whether it was Trump, Obama, Carter. You know, here's somebody that's the president of the United States, and yet when it comes to a debate, they still get prepped for the debate. So even if you're a great lieutenant, you still got to get prepped. And here's the mistake that I see happening to a lot of individuals of all races, is that when they prep for their oral exam or assessment center, they prep with individuals they're comfortable with. And then when they go to the exam, now the nerves kick in, and I've seen people that can perform well at a fire where those nerves in an oral exam kind of stymies them. So the best person to prep with is an individual that makes you feel a little uncomfortable, because then you'll kill that oral exam. So no matter what you've accomplished in your career, always prep with, you know, a couple different people so that you can prepare for that assessment center.
That's absolutely right, because I do assessment centers too, and I travel around with, you know, different companies. When a lot of times they'll send us our training department, you know, we're reaching out, do you have any captains or whatever, or chiefs that can come and, you know, be assessors for these different tests, you know, around the country. So I've done a few of those around the country, and you're absolutely right. I could tell the person who, not necessarily they're gifted in talking in front of people, but you can tell the person who practiced it, you know, and they practice it, then they're very succinct. They're very they go down the line very logical. They fall within the time limit of delivering the information that we requested, and it's easy to, you know, mark them when they're doing it. And then you see some guys that you just know, you got the feeling that you know this guy's experience. you know this guy knows his stuff. But when it comes to delivering the dialogue to us, they don't do such a good job at that. You know, so you're right about that. You have to, it had to be intentional preparation, and intentional preparation with people who are going to give you some honest feedback, or you tape yourself or watch yourself or the whole thing. So you're absolutely right about that.
Speaking of prepping, there is something that I think might would help too. Test taking is its own skill, no matter what the kind of test you're taking. So sometimes it's been helpful from, you know, situations that I've heard of in the past and known about, that there is a skill of just knowing how to take a test, not just knowing the material. Of course, you need to know that, but just test taking skills.
Definitely. We talked, you know,
I mean, that,
O'Neill,
that,
right?
That could be taught as a, you know, extra thing to learn how to do, period. And that applies to any test that you're taking.
You remember Mama Elaine, we had Dennis O'Neill on, and he kind of co-signed you on that particular topic. And you know Dennis O'Neill, right, Frank? And we had him on the show, and he talked about how he would practice taking the test over and over again. You know, the test, he would do 1,000 questions a day, and, you know, or whatever, and then see where his weakness was, and perfected the test taking methodology down. He was a mentor to Lenny Carmichael and John Austin in test preparation and taking tests and things like that. So not only knowing the material, but also becoming a student of test taking. And whether it's written and the oral, and definitely both you need for promotion. So that needs to be in the mix as well. And if you're talking about make sure people are prepared.
And Larry, it's not just for the test though. Like a lot of individuals try to separate the assessment center or the skills, knowledge, and abilities part of their test with how they operate. And what I always say is, you know, As a union president, listen, I hold officers with a lot of esteem, but I put my foot up a lot of officers, I always say the badge is a shield if you do everything right, okay? But if you take the badge off and do things wrong as an officer, it's got a pin, it's got that sword. And as a union president, I'd put that right through your heart, because the fact of the matter is, one of the things I'd ask the officer is this how you would handle the situation in an assessment center or an oral interview?
Right.
And they would look and say, no. And I'd be like, well, that's why you're failing here. Because if I can't defend the act, I'm attacking the process. And people need to realize that it's not just for the test. If you're saying it in an assessment center, well, then you should apply that in real life as well.
That's true. And sometimes there is that separation.
Is the assessment part of you passing or doing what you're supposed to do, know how to do? Is the assessment, is that something separate? I'm kind of breaking
down.
No,
the assessment, all of it's the same. The testing process usually consists of a written, and the assessment part of it is your oral presentation. And, you know, what would you do in this situation, or what would you do? You present it with a scenario, and then you have to respond what you do in that scenario. So what Frank is saying is that people operating in the street totally different than what they're doing in the assessment center, and then they get in trouble for that. Then he's saying if you were presented that in the assessment center, you should be doing it close to, similar, or exactly as you would do it in the street. And they polar opposites, then it's hard to defend you as a union because you didn't do things according to what the SOGs, the SOPs said. So you can't be cowboy in the street and want defense because if the cowboy goes against what you would do in the assessment center.
So I'm saying when you're preparing to become whatever the role you're trying to play or the rank or whatever, assessments, doing an assessment is part of the process of getting passing the test or whatever. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Part of the poker. Okay. Yes. So that still requires a test taking skill. You still need to put it up under the same umbrella. You might call it by a different name, but if it's part of what you have to do to pass, then that's still something you need to look at under the same, you know, and from the same point of view. This is still a skill I need to learn how to do, just like I need to learn how to do it on paper or oral questions or whatever. It's still the same.
Yeah.
Still part of a test.
Oh, no. I mean, it's all, I mean, when we say test taking, you can't take one part of the test and not the other. So if you're doing the test, if you're taking a promotional exam, it's all, so you can't cherry pick and say, well, I'm good at taking the test, but, you know, I'm really not going to do the oral exam or the assessment part of it. You got to do it all. So, to your point, if you're practicing the written part, you definitely have to practice, like Frank said earlier, you have to practice the oral part of it as well. Practice it in front of people who make you uncomfortable. Practice it. Practice in front of a camera. Yeah. Practice in front of a mirror. Practice. So it's all the same thing, just different parts of the same thing. But it all is going to require practice no matter what part of it you're taking.
When I was talking about test taking, I should have qualified it. I wasn't just talking about the written. I'm talking about whatever the test or whatever they're tested on, verbally, slot testing, whatever's involved. It covers, it's still a test. It's still something you got to do in order to pass and then get the promotion or get the job or whatever. That's all. Not just for written. I wasn't meaning that to apply only to written text.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the thing is called, from oral processes, actual show, you know, you all doing the functions that you do or whatever, all of those things, you know, fall under that practicing the concept, because you still got the mindset when you're doing all of this stuff that you're taking a test to pass so you go to the next rank where you get the job or whatever. So whether it's mechanical, verbal, written, whatever, there's a skill of taking tests.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of people practice that segment, and that's why a lot of people even go to the classes to make you go through the paces, you know, because they're going to make you go through the paces to master the art of test taking or, you know, even before the testing process happens, you know. I usually tell my recruits when they come out the class, start now in practicing the process of test taking in this process, because by the time it's time to do it for real, it's kind of review for you and not necessarily a brand new process, you know. But, well, just to start to wrap things up, really enjoyed having you on the show and really expressing all these examples of mutual victory. And I can understand that you probably started out as a recruit, you didn't think that you're going to be, you know, famous and talking to Supreme Court and talking to federal court appointees and battling out with mayors and all that kind of stuff. Did you have a premonition that this is going to be your fate there, Mr. Richard?
No, of course not. You know, life kind of chooses you, Larry. Look at the great work that you and your brother have done for firefighters across the country. It just kind of, it's probably because of your mother and the proper upbringing that you had. But the fact of the matter is,
you got to get points on the board, Frank. You just got some, okay?
Oh, see, I like, but no,
you just
passed
your test. Okay, no, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
The goal of any parent is to have their sons be a credit to them, and your sons, you should be proud of both of your sons, and you know, life kind of finds you. And the one thing that I think I was able to accomplish was to not allow the case to define me, and that's one thing. Like, if you're an instructor out there, don't try to let one thing. You know, if you're out there, you're a firefighter, you're listening to this, and you know, you want to get to FDIC, you want to you want to start training firefighters around the country like Larry, it's not that hard. But submit an article to Fire Engineering. And listen, if you're not all squared away with writing, I'm dyslexic. I have trouble with writing. And here I'm writing a book. So the fact of the matter is, reach out to Larry, reach out to me and say, or anybody, and say, hey, let's write it together. Most of the articles that you'll ever see that I put forward, or DVDs that I put forward, I always have individuals in them. And a kind of a cool story here is when I did the Tactical Perspectives DVDs that are still relevant today, I put a whole bunch of people in it. And a lot of people said, oh, you're minimizing your brand. And I said, no. I said, by kind of sharing the spotlight and putting individuals in these DVDs, it's just going to make it that much better. And it did. Mm-hmm. It absolutely did. So you'll see that if you read an article by Frank Ritchie, I usually write it with somebody else. It's a way to build and mentor people and kind of get them. But anybody can accomplish what Larry, David, and myself has accomplished. You know, just get out there. Everybody has value. If you work in St. Louis, you have value to a lot of city departments. But if you're in a small department, I see individuals say, oh, well, you know, I can't compete with somebody from New Haven, New York, St. Louis. No, most of the country is small. Everybody has a perspective. Don't try to write over your perspective, but as long as you, you know, kind of embrace that perspective of where you're at, you know, we want to hear from you at Fire Engineering. And, you know, like I said, don't just do one thing. Try to diversify what you do. And that was one of the things that I think I was really successful at, is that I didn't get pigeonholed into, hey, I'm a one-trick pony, it's all about the lawsuit, because really it's about training firefighters and making firefighters safe and aggressive and safe, but also, you know, giving back to the community. So that's kind of where I'm at. And it's been an honor to be on your show, and thank you for Mom, David, and Larry for all you do for Fire Engineering. And I really look forward to seeing you at FDIC, and I really thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you sharing with us. You teach in a class this next month at FDIC, right?
I'm teaching this year. I'm taking a break from leadership. I want to kind of get back to the nit and gritty. So Wednesday I'm teaching. It's still about the victim aggressive search. So if morning sessions, if somebody wants to learn about search, I teach it from the company, the individual task level, the tactical level, and the strategic level. So whether you're a firefighter, a company officer, or a chief, this search class is for you. So stop by and see us and check out Larry's class. And hopefully Larry changes the name of the show to help out his brother.
That would be lovely.
We're working on it. We got our legal people looking at it right now. So we'll get back to you.
See if we can get a mutual victory clause in there.
Let's wrap up with Elaine. You can start. David, you're next, and then I'll back clean up.
Well, this was really very interesting. I learned a whole lot more about processing and prepping and those kinds of things. But I looked you up, Frank, and everything I looked up was about the lawsuit. So I don't know what you're trying to say. But I found other stuff as well. But I think you're doing a great job.
Like long walks in the park and all that stuff.
Pina coladas from getting caught in the rain.
Put the music to it. Put the music to it. But no, keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's it. I'm out. And hopefully Larry and I are going to have some pina coladas in the rain at FDIC. And everybody have a great night. And thank you for having me on.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Frank.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
David, go ahead. David, go ahead. Say what you had to say. And Frank had a...
No, I was just going to say it was a... I was just going to say it was... I thought it was a great call. I appreciate Dave calling in to give us some sensible callers. So we appreciate that. but also, just the notion of the whole... case, but how these guys could still, even after that, have the respect to give each other letters of recommendation and send people there to learn about the case and to learn about how people can come together even when they are on opposing sides of a particular issue to try to work out the best thing for that issue. And I think that's something that people in the world, you look at the news, you see places where people in the world and, you know, just even in the country itself could learn from that and from, you know, what the mutual victory atmosphere that these gentlemen have with regard to that, you know, a lot more would get solved for the greater good if we could do that. So just find the opportunities to see that and seek that mutual victory. That's my takeaway.
I'll wrap it up by saying, David, next time you see the caller ID, say Riff Raff on it. Don't let that guy through.
Right.
You know, so,
right,
so.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Riff Raff.
I want to say,
Don't
just because it shows at night don't mean it's got to be moonshine, you know.
Right. Don't answer that one. You know? But anyway, yeah, I just want to, you know, and we probably have another time to where we can talk. I know we've had guests on before to where we sometimes we have them on again and kind of delve a little bit more in the different parts of what we talked about, but I did think this was a great examples of mutual victory in all of it, you know, and showing that because you know Frank doesn't back down from where he stands and who he is, and the other side doesn't either, and that's good. But you don't have to. Can we work together for the greater good? And it looks like in all of these instances, so all these different points he mentioned. That was the prevailing thought of having mutual victory. And I really want to just highlight that because we are living in times now where it seems like that's a strange understanding is to have mutual victory. I don't agree with you, so you're dead to me, and that's kind of a bad thing. But it's really bad when you're a firefighter, and it's really bad when you work in teams as intimate as our teams as firefighters. So, so we have to do it. We are America's heroes in a lot of ways, and from a domestic standpoint, of course, our troops are heroes overseas and defending our way of life, and police are the heroes in how they defend our streets. But in our regard, the heroes working as teams. If the heroes can't get it right at home, then how are we going to get it right in the street? And we have to constantly understand that. And we can't afford to cancel each other out. Let that be people who either don't get it or still have some growth to do. But us, we have to have an accelerated understanding about it. We got to understand that right now, because the if we let that infect the fire service, what we're seeing now in our country, and we let that infect the fire service, I don't know what's going to happen because, you know, we're a lot of times the last hope. And so we got to be careful in there. And I think there was a time when that wasn't a big problem. But I think with social media, a lot of information being disseminated real fast, it's become popular to be going against stuff just for the fact of going against it, not because there's an actual reason to it. We know it's a lot of soul searching we're going to have to do as a country, but definitely we can't afford to be that in our fire service. So that's my kind of takeaway and wrap up. And I'm glad we have Frank on to have somebody who can have this kind of spectacular event happen, but still have some mutual victory come out of it, you know. So that was we met our goal tonight in making sure that particular lesson was taught, so to speak, and hopefully people who listen have some takeaways that they could take back and start making sure that they take a take an extra look at what they're doing back home. David and I are going to be hitting the road pretty soon. I know we got to do a Missouri tour here at the end of March, and then starting in April, we're going to be all over the place. I'll be in D.C. at the Congressional Fire Service thing I always wanted to go to. So that should be kind of cool. So I'll be doing that with my good buddy Brian Zeitz, another fire service instructor here in Missouri, an all-around great guy. And then I think we're going to be crisscrossing the nation and then also end up at our beloved FDIC at the end of April. So we're looking forward to that. Our class will be Thursday at FDIC, so make sure you check us out, the Rescue and the Leading Inside of You, and we'll have fun with that. You come guaranteed paradigm shift, guaranteed. You come to
all
the
right.
class, guaranteed. Yeah, I can't guarantee a lot, you know, but I can't guarantee that. So all the other I can guarantee is child support and taxes. But paradigm shifts in our classes, I've added that to the list. So we are checking out Thursday, FDIC. It's going to be a great time. We're back in April, y'all. We did it August last year, so we're back in April. The only reason
you can guarantee the paradigm shift is you have more dimes now that your child support is up.
More than
a paradigm.
Right. You got 20 cent now. We're here all week. These are the kind of jokes you make here in our class. The FDIC. So nobody sleeps in our class, you know. Have you been entertained? You know, but.
Right.
But we'll be there and in all this glory. But check out all the great classes. There's going to be a lot of great classes. A lot of great people. And like I said every year, the one thing I like about FDIC is that, you know, you got some rock stars that are there. People have written many books, many articles, legends at FDIC. And one thing about it, these are going to kiss the ring type people. You can walk up to anybody and if they got a few minutes, they can talk to you and answer any questions you got. So that's what I love about the fire service in this regard, is that you can read about somebody who has read their books, sent their classes, and you approach them at the FDIC, they're going to talk to you. They're not too busy for you. So keep that in mind as you come and network, get as much information as you can, and then take it back and give it to your department, and so we can continue to make this the greatest fire service, the American fire service. We can continue to be the best we can in this world. And pray for the people overseas who are going through what they're going through, wars and these uncertain times. Continue to pray for them. I know people here complaining about gas prices and all that. And I thought about that the other day. I was almost getting ready to join a bandwagon to complain about gas price. And I know it affects me and it affects other people. But I got to thinking, I could be hiding out in the subway bunker with bombs and stuff all over me, rubble and stuff coming down.
That's right.
So you know what? I'll pay a few extra dollars in gas. So it's all good.
Yeah.
You know, so, but we continue to pray for wars that are going on everywhere. The most pronounced one now, of course, is Ukraine. But there's always a war or some atrocities going on somewhere. So just pray for everybody who is not as lucky as you are. You know. So check us out. Check our website out. www.glutenationldc.com. Also check out our Facebook page and our social media presence to see where Larry and David will be. We got a great summer tour lined up, so if you check out the website, it'll tell you where we are, where we're going to be. And if we come into a town near you, then we'd be glad to meet you. Come on out and say you heard the show, and if you like what we're saying, cool. And if you don't like what we're saying, don't approach us. You might get beat up. No, seriously. you could also approach us, too, and we could see how we could do this thing better. So it was great doing it live, and we'll have another great guest in another 7 weeks. We're also going to be live from FDIC, so check us out live from FDIC. Look at the schedule, and we'll do that live every year. Hopefully we can get a great guest on this year, and I think this year we have Frank Viscuso doing the keynote, so I'm looking forward to that. So it's going to be a great year, whether we go on through stuff or not. It's going to be a great year. So,
yeah.
So everybody just stay safe.
Think positive and keep praying.
Yeah, keep praying, stay safe, and pray. And, hey, when you get to work, hey, have dinner with your people. Hug your people, because you never know when you might not see them again. And continue to pray for us at Truck 13C as we continue to work through our grief with the loss of our brother, firefighter Benjamin Paulson. But I think that's all I got, Dave. And Dave, that's all Dave has, and that's all Mommy Lane has. So we'll see you guys in 7 weeks. See you guys at FDIC, and stay safe, and have a great rest of your week.
Yeah. All right. We out.
Shalom. Mm-hmm.